So tonight we decided, I decided, because yesterday was Father's Day, which I had a wonderful one, practicing it in the good old Stoltz method. I enjoyed what Niles Crane from this TV show Frasier called American Peasant Food. I'm a big fan of American peasant food, so I enjoyed KFC, chili dogs from Red Rabbit. You haven't been there? Best dogs around. And Meadows ice cream, best custard in the world. And lots of good cigars and a double feature drive-in of the works of Mr. Spielberg. So it was a great day for me. A great day to give thanks for all those fathers and all those people who played our father role in our lives. To that I am so grateful. So we're departing tonight from Free Your Mind, which we will continue again next week. So if you haven't got a copy yet, please get one. And instead, tonight we're going to talk about the role of fathers. In fact, the talk is called Embodied Oneness. You know, the vitality of the role of the father in both our personal lives and social. I'm going to be using a book that I wrote back in 2007 called Free Your Mind, The Four Direction System of Mindfulness. This is the system that we use to interpret and practice the way of oneness in the legacy of the Buddha. And so tonight's reading is actually from Carl Jung. Very simple one. But humankind is masculine and feminine, not just man or woman. Carl Jung. So what does this mean? Well, let me start first with how we at the Dragonfly Sangha understand the nature of gender and the nature of sexuality. What's evident from science, since we always turn to science to try to gain some knowledge, what's evident from science, if you go from, you know, the smallest little creatures all the way up to big creatures like us and the primates. All of these creatures have spectrums of sexuality. So if you think of a spectrum here and here, you will find that many creatures are in various levels of that. Now, as creatures evolve into mammals and then evolve into primates, that becomes a bit less varied, so to speak. You know, for example, in the animal world, there are certain frogs that in under certain duress or certain circumstances, they will change sex. We also know this is true for some forms of fish. When we get into the mammal world, we find that most of the time, people are either born as male or female. However, when we get into primates, particularly human beings, we do find that there are also other forms. While the majority, the vast majority, have biological chromosomes and hormones which would make them male or female, there also is, on a very rare occasion, something that's called hermaphrodite. And this would be a very rare occasion where either the person has both sexual organs or, again, this is very rare, starts out with one sexual organ and then has another one develop. For example, there's a famous medical case of a child that was born female, and then by the time that child reached puberty, began to develop into a male. Testicles descended, the clitoris became enlarged and grew into, I guess, a penis, and it was just turning into a male. And in fact, that human went on to sire many children. So we know that it's varied. And then there's another group that we call intersex. And that group, and that was a term that goes back to the early 1900s. And that's to describe someone who may have one set of organs, but has other variations going on genetically. And then, of course, there are those who, out of choice, change their gender. And in this case, we're talking about transgender persons. And I don't think of them all the same. I think that they're different. I think we should honor the differences greatly. And when it comes to the role of human beings in raising families, then we know for certain that there is a definite difference that goes on. A lot of studies in neurology have shown that the male brain, and I'm going to talk mainly about male and female tonight, that the male brain and the female brain are different. And that there is a lot of different things that drive that. No one's 100% certain what that is or what that cause is, but we know that it's a mixture of what we call nature and nurture. And as the quote by Carl Jung makes clear, every human being has aspects that could be defined as masculine and feminine. Now, I don't like to use those terms too much because they're very confusing. What I prefer to use is a model that comes from the Chinese interpretation of the Buddhist teaching. In that interpretation, the way is known as the Tao. And the Tao represents the dynamic nature of the universe, so that we have both a yin and a yang, both of those working together to be generative and creative. And so our path, our practice is about experiencing and achieving balancing. And so what we want to do is we want to balance these various different things within us. So if I'm a male, I want to bring into harmony and balance the yin aspects. So if I'm male, I have more yang orientation, so I need to bring in the yin to balance that out. Likewise for a female, again, I'm just using those two designations, you need to bring in the yang, because of the yin orientation. And you'll find this is true throughout. So even when you look at personality types, using the Jungian personality types explicated by Myers-Briggs, you have folks that are introverted, folks that are extroverted. They have an orientation, but one must learn to integrate and become balanced in order to experience the fullest life, the fullest embodiment. And so that is always our task. How do these things work together? How do we bring balance? Now, if you're familiar with the four direction system, what I did was I took the teachings of the Buddha and I translated them following the Koyi method that the Chinese used way back, 1,000 years ago, to interpret the Buddha's teachings through the Chinese culture. They call this Koyi, which is where we get the word Tao from, to describe, just as I mentioned. What I did was I used psychotherapeutic language, psychological language that we would be more comfortable with in the West, and make it easier for us to grasp and integrate these teachings and ideas. So one of the very important models that we work with, we have various what we would call mindfulness models that we will apply, is the idea that each human being goes through various stages of development. And that these stages of development are both social and physiological. And I don't know if you'll be able to see this in the book, but in the book it's on page 8, where we lay out this model of the principle or cycle of interdependent causation. Now, one of the things you'll notice down here is what we call the stages of development, or the aggregate stages. And each of these stages represents a psychosocial development, both involving nature and nurture. And each of these 5 skandhas, or states, evolves to develop sankhara, or the idea of an ego self. The first stage is the genetic stage that we inherit from our mother and father. We inherit from all the ancestors and all the lineage going way back to the very beginnings of evolution. And if you look at the fetus and you look at its development, there's very interesting parallels that you will find. For example, the fetus appears to be able to breathe in liquid. There's even a time where there seem to be gill-like features, fish-like features, chicken-like features. And we also know that humans all seem to be female in the beginning. And then in the last stages of gestation, become male, if they're going to become male. So it's a fascinating world. And that first stage of development brings with us all the things we inherit. Now that means the color of my eyes are blue, which is not that common, and it only goes back a few, I think some people say like 10,000 years for the first blue-eyed folk. Could be wrong about that, but I think it's around that stage. Maybe it was a little later than that, earlier than that. But not just my eyes, but even maybe the color of ice cream I like may have somewhat of a biological origin. We don't know, and no one's absolutely certain. So in the four-direction system, we just say 50-50. And then this is the fetus as it grows and then is born, the mother gives birth. And at this stage, the relationship from the time of in utero to the time the child is somewhere around 7 years of age, that relationship to the mother or whoever is playing that role in the child's life, that relationship is where we say that the feeling stage is created. And usually what will happen is that the little human being will either adopt the attributes of the mother emotionally, or they will develop an aversion to it. And why that is a bit of a mystery. It's an alchemy of different things. But this role is very important and is one that sets up the third stage. And the third stage is what we're going to focus on tonight. The third stage, so you might say that second stage is the yin stage. And the third stage is the yang stage. So that stage is dominated by whoever our father is, or whomever plays that role in our lives. And here's what we found. And it's not just us. Not only in my clinical pastoral counseling experience over the last 3 decades have I seen this bear out, but this is also something that was very clear to the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and others like Carl Jung. And that is that this stage of development is the most critical stage of development for the human being. Now, that's not saying that the stage or role of the yin isn't equally important. In fact, that's the foundation. But as we develop this into this stage, which happens around 8 or 9 years of age, depending on the precociousness of the child, the child begins to develop a perception of the world around him. At this stage, if this stage is not good, so in other words, if someone, the father or someone to play that role, is absent from the child's life at this stage, particularly, although I think both yin and yang, both mother and father play a critical role throughout. If this is messed up, then this is where most of the trouble comes from. Not that you can't have bad mothers, don't get me wrong. But in terms of the impact, it's that third stage. And so the role of the father is incredibly critical. Now, that's not just coming from the spiritual tradition. This is also coming from science. One of the things that we found from all the varieties of studies that have gone on, and I would say gone on most recently as we've developed greater skill and understanding about neurology and genetics, is that in many cases, the father's influence is more consequential to outcomes than anything else. That's what scientific study has discovered. And I've found that to be completely true in my own experience. And I'll give you examples. So this is an objective phenomenon. And it's very clear that the human being leans on that yang stage for social development. And in some cases, the mother's influence even becomes less as the human being develops. Now again, it doesn't mean the mother isn't very critical and important, or doesn't play a large role in our lives, throughout our lives. It just means that when it comes to some of these neuroses, when it comes to some of the bad stuff, it's dad, not mom. And so this is where, well, let me just talk about this for a moment before I go into that. We had a bias towards mother being the source of problems or the source of psychological issues. There was no real science behind this. This was largely influenced by Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud, who had an unusually close relationship to his mother, who called him her golden Siggy, influenced Freud's understanding of that dynamic and relationship. And so there was an overemphasis on blaming mom for things. And even up and through the 70s, the 60s and 70s and 80s, part of the 80s, even experts were saying that the father's role was not that consequential. Boy, were they wrong. All the ancient wisdom disagreed with that. And all of the scientific knowledge that we've developed henceforth completely disagrees with that. Okay? So there'll be no blaming mother here tonight. But dad? So let me just give you, there's a big list here. I wrote them out because it's a huge list. Here's what happens if a father is really good. And that means, now what does that mean? I'm going to talk about that. What does it mean to be a mindful father, an awakened father? Obviously, it doesn't mean perfection, but I'll talk more about that. So let me talk about, here's the things that have been shown study after study with tens of thousands of human beings followed over long periods of time. Children that have healthy fathers who are present in their lives, develop more independence. They're more independent in their thinking. They're more independent in their sense of direction. They're more independent in believing that they can handle things. They have greater sense of self-worth or self-estimation. They have less feelings of inadequacy. They have more emotional stability. They have a greater sense of responsiveness to not just the things that are oriented around yang, but they have a more balanced sense of yin. And their view of the world tends to be more optimistic than pessimistic. Here's some of the stuff that happens if it's bad. First, they're more likely to be criminals. They're more likely to commit crimes and go to prison. They're more likely to be involved in early and careless sexual practices, and sometimes aggressive sexual practices. They don't do as well in school and academics. They don't develop a healthy work life. They tend to gender stereotype. Children that have a healthy father, where nurturing has been demonstrated. I'm going to talk a little more about why that's so important. They're more balanced in their view. There's more anger and aggression in children who do not have a healthy father. There's more behavioral problems in general. There's more substance abuse, drug and alcoholism. There's more depression among children who had unhealthy fathers. And overall, their cognitive scores and their whole adjustment to life is maladjusted. Now I could go on. Those are just a few. So this is an objective phenomenon. So we know this is the case. Now the ancient wisdom knew this. On the part of the Buddhists knew this and understood this. And when it came to archetypes or object images for meditation, yidams, things of that nature, the yang, the masculine, was always associated with compassion. And the yin, or the feminine, was always associated with wisdom. Always. Now, why was this? Why did they intentionally do this? Because they understood it. While they may not have some of the knowledge or the technology that we have, they had wisdom. They had great wisdom, sometimes surpassing even our own. And what they understood was that the masculine, the yang, is more likely to be aggressive and more likely to show that in physical form and including sexual forms. And, you know, one of the facts is that males tend to be more violent than females. So they knew this, and they knew in order to help create balance, they made the yang imagery masculine. Because they wanted to encourage males to embody and balance the yang with the yin. And so they became symbols of compassion. Likewise, for the yin, or the feminine, it was to encourage wisdom to balance out the yin factor in women. And I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I my own personal theory is that the reason that God figures tended to be male was not because of some, you know, lack of equality. It was more about that same probably intuitive understanding that males needed an image of a compassionate being. And I'm talking about deities that emphasize compassion. Again, most strongly delineated in the Buddhist tradition, but you can find it in the other ones, the more theistic versions. And so compassion was the way within which males needed to have images, objects, and nurture in order to balance out themselves. So the thing that we understand from this is that if we want to have a healthy society, in other words, a society that is progressing both in knowledge and in wisdom, the role of the yang, the role of the father, is without question, probably, at least in this stage of our evolution, the most critical. If we want to build better societies, we must emphasize, and this is a call out to all the fathers or would-be fathers out there, I am calling you out to live out the vocation of being a father, which is a noble one and one of the most challenging, to live it out fully and completely and clearly with both wisdom and compassion. Because if you don't, that's where most of the best is going to come. If you want to make a culture better, if you really want to help make things better, then we need to have good fathers. We need to have good people playing that yang role, because without it, it's disastrous. And the less we emphasize that, it is my experience and opinion, the more our culture and civilization will fall apart. This was demonstrated to me over and over again throughout my counseling career, and to this day. But it was probably the biggest smack in the face about this to me was the first 8 to 10 years of my career, which was focused on working with those who had been in prison, both going into federal, state, and local prisons, both in Pennsylvania and in Boston and Massachusetts, and also working with gangs and running a halfway house. And working with both males and females, mostly males, but a large number of females, particularly in Boston. And the thing that I found over and over again, without fail, not one of those individuals had a healthy, present father in their life. Not one. Not one. Without exception. Without exception. I'll never forget visiting night in one of the local jails that I worked in, one of the first places I went into. And it was somewhat primitive. On visiting nights, on Fridays, all the inmates would line on one side of the fence. This was inside the building. And all the visitors would line up on the other side of the fence. Guess what? There were lots of mothers, lots of grandmothers, lots of girlfriends, but not one single male. And I'm talking about 150 inmates on one side and over 100 on the other side, and not one, not once. So you can argue this any you want, but the science, the knowledge, and the experience, there's no question. This is an objective phenomenon. Okay, so that's the problem, right? So what's the solution? The solution is this. If you are going to have a child, in my opinion, you must give that child the best foundation you can. Ideally, my opinion is that it should be a mixture of yin and yang. And it should be a committed relationship. I believe in that very much. I'm kind of old-fashioned that way. While I'm incredibly liberal when it comes to sexuality, when it comes to the foundation of a family, I am old-fashioned because I believe that is wisdom. And if you're going to have a child, you should be involved in that child's life from the beginning. And let me tell you something. That responsibility doesn't end when the child turns 16 or 18 or 21. Pick your version of when you think someone that's post-pubescent is an adult. Nature has its own ideas. Sometimes society creates false ones. But the fact of the matter is, that doesn't end. It never ends. And if you're not willing to take that kind of commitment, to make that kind of vow, don't do it. Because any fool, any idiot can get a woman pregnant. But being a father, being a man, a male, a person who takes a yang, who takes responsibility, that's totally different. So what does it mean to be a mindful father? It means you need to be involved from the beginning. And again, you're never going to be perfect. So the goal isn't to be perfect. The goal is to most of the time do it well. And I would say for both parents, it's even more important that you show them not how you're perfect and never mess up, but what to do when you mess up. That's more important because guess what? They're not perfect either, and they will mess up, and they need to know that just as well. Be involved. Studies have shown that fathers who are involved in infancy help the child develop more quickly. Studies have shown that fathers who are engaged with their children, who play with them different than yin do. Yang plays different than yin. It involves roughhousing. It involves wrestling. It involves maybe a little less protection. And that's not a stereotype. Studies have borne that out. And of course, there are exceptions. The studies have borne out that fathers who are engaged with their children, who take an interest in their children's interest, because all too often, the child is supposed to have the interests of the parent. But when the father takes interest in the interests of the child and also pursues and motivates those and nurtures those, man, you just produce good human beings. And if you want to avoid all that list of negative things and you want to encourage the list of positive things, that's what you got to do. You got to be involved in their life. Now, being a mindful father, what does that mean? It means you've got to practice on yourself. You've got to practice the four directions. You have to be grounded. You have to practice every day to balance yourself out. You need to show the yin partner in that relationship equal devotion and commitment. I've often said to people, if you want to have your children turn out well, then what they look at every day, that relationship between the mother and father, that is critical. That must be good. When I say not perfect, it must be good. I've had several cases of children that have come here with all kinds of troubles, and I discovered that it was, and understood that it was probably going on with the mother and the father. If I was able to work with the mother and father, particularly the father, I never even had to do anything to children. I remember one boy who had enuresis, bedwetting. All I did was work with the parents and mainly with the father, and I never talked to the boy more than once. And guess what? The bedwetting disappeared. And that happened time and time again. And sometimes, at some stages, you're going to find that your children, your kids, will start to become their own human being. And you must let them become their own human being. It's hard. It's not easy. because you spend so much time loving and caring and protecting them. But there's a certain stage where you have to let go of some of that. And if you don't allow your relationship to grow into maturity, then that relationship with that child will never leave that stage. And your kids will find that they'll spend less and less time with you. If you want your kids around for a long time, raise them well. Raise them well. One of my Tibetan teachers used to say, if you want your children to take care of you in old age, you better make sure you remember that now. How you treat them now will dictate a lot of what happens later. And fathers need a lot of support. Our society today, unfortunately, has lost sight of the wisdom of the need for the yang to be balanced and good. Men need support, fathers need support, yang proponents need support. They need to have models in other males that they can understand how to develop that balance, how to become compassionate yang. And when they do, it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. And again, at another time I will talk more about the yin, but because of Father's Day being yesterday, I just felt like I really needed to say something about this. Really do. Because if you want to make the world a better place, have healthier families. Healthier families don't create kids that go out and destroy the world. They just don't. Healthier kids have a sense of belonging. That sense of oneness is nurturing. And when you embody that oneness by living out of that place of balance, hey, your children are going to go through their own struggles in life, but trust me, by example, they will not end up in these statistics. I'll leave you with this. In the story of the Buddha, which is a story, it's a parable, it's not literal. When the Buddha comes back from his experience of awakening, one of the first persons that he becomes engaged with is his son and his wife. And of course, they both want to be reconnected together. But Shakyamuni says, before we can do that, you must know that while I am your father and I am your husband, you are first and foremost a brother and sister in the Sangha. You are an equal. You are an equal. And that is the first place that I will go. Sure, we have these roles that have been set up by society and evolution. But first and foremost, you are my equal. And I can learn from you. We can learn from each other. And I think that's so important because that's the way I approach it. When I look at my wife of 35 years, I look at her first as a sister in the Dharma, a sister in the Sangha, and then all the other things that come in to being my wife and my best friend. When I look at my son, I look at him first as a brother in the Dharma, and then all those other wonderful things about being his dad. And he being my son. And I think that creates a nice foundation for how you go about things. We need each other in this. As it's been famously said, it takes a village. That didn't mean that you throw the kids out to society and expect society to take care of your children. Because you know what? If you don't take care of them, society's measures are not good. Are not healthy. And no one will care for your children the way you do. But what I take from that saying is, that we must support each other as parents. We must support each other as brothers and sisters in the song. And that's what the song is for. And that's why we don't just take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma. We take refuge in the Sangha, the family of practitioners, the beloved community. It's equal to Buddha and Dharma. But we forget that. We expect these communities just to go on their own. But they won't unless you, as practitioners, are there to support them and nurture them and strengthen them.